the Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, 'tis the season to be jolly is a song which commemorates Christmas, but anything but jolly is the way the people of this land, Palestinians, feel as they are under continued attack. Burqa, near Nablus, the city 2 hours away from Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, has been the scene of increased settler violence accompanied by Israeli forces against the Palestinian people. It was supposed to be a holy night, but instead Burqa witnessed at least 250 Palestinians being wounded. Well, what would Jesus say about what regularly occurs now in the land where he was born?
Israel is stepping up its acts of violence against Palestinians with impunity. Attacks by settlers have grown more audacious recently. In the latest incident, over 250 Palestinian protesters were injured in an Israeli attack on the village of Burqa near Nablus in the occupied West Bank that happened late Sunday. From live rounds and tear gas to rubber bullets and stun grenades, the Israeli forces fired everything they could to ward off the Palestinian protesters. It all started when the Israeli army moved in, deploying soldiers to the Nablus-Jenin road to secure dozens of buses packed with settlers. They also closed off the entrance to the village of Burqa. And that infuriated the Palestinians and triggered protests. In recent days, Burqa has been a flashpoint of clashes. Israeli settlers, with protection from the army, have attempted to raid Palestinian houses there. In a separate accident that happened a few days ago, an Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian woman, killing her near Ramallah in the northern West Bank. It came just hours after settlers attacked a nearby village that rapidly escalated into a round of violence with Israeli troops firing rubber bullets and tear gas and injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Pro-Palestinian activist Paul Lorodi believes that Tel Aviv is seeking a policy of isolating Palestinians and forcing them out of their homes.
But the strategy of the Israelis has been to surround large cities like Nablus, as they did in Qarqilia, and to isolate them and to destroy their economy and to basically to force Palestinians to find work elsewhere.
The atrocities go on, but the international community remains silent. That has raised criticisms that the lack of global reaction to the situation in fact gives the green light to the Israeli regime to continue with its unjust policies. Even the UN has lashed out at the world community for remaining tight-lipped in the face of the Israeli crimes. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, says the international community must hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He says Tel Aviv is refusing to comply with the UN resolutions, including UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which calls for an end to settlement expansion in the occupied territories. Anti-war activist Ken Stone believes a concerted international effort is needed to tackle the situation.
Behind the colonial project in Palestine is the might of the U.S. empire. And the U.S. and its allies, including, unfortunately, Canada, enable this kind of mistreatment of the Palestinians.
Palestinians are witnessing bolder and more violent attacks with each passing day, and they are waiting to see when the international community will finally move to stop the injustice.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political analyst out of London, and Dawood Khotab, award-winning Palestinian journalist out of Amman.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Hafsa, I want to start off a little bit different this time because perhaps it's the season, but in general, you know, in Western media especially, they never talk about the Christian-Palestinian side of things as if there are no Christian-Palestinians. I want to talk about this because actually more and more Christian-Palestinians, the leaders have warned that their community is under threat of violence as the settler violence has also increase against them. Your take on this and why we see this not being talked about, and even we know there's a big Christian Zionist community in the West, especially in the United States, that's very pro-Zionist regime.
Well, there are two aspects. First of all, I think Christian faith and Christian spirituality and Christian values have been almost erased from Western culture and society, and therefore everything that Christmas stands for has actually been taken out of its essence and turned into a sort of a capitalist fest that almost represents everything that Jesus opposed. So I think in that respect, you can almost understand the context in which there is no longer any humanity, no longer any wish to express solidarity with the oppressed of this world, which is what Jesus's message was all about. So that's the spiritual element. On the other element, of course, is that the media, the Zionist media, is very much in control of a media outlet, and therefore they simply refuse to broadcast information that shows the suffering of Christians. Because, of course, if you all remember when we had ISIS, for instance, targeting Yazidis or Christians, that was all over the news, and rightly so, obviously, because this terrorist organization was targeting Christians. But when these Zionists, when you have Jewish extremists that are insulting and defaming the Virgin Mary, writing graffitis on churches, and then taking it a step further and massacring Palestinians and destroying their celebrations, you have no coverage whatsoever in the mainstream media, as if those Christians absolutely have no value in the eyes of other fellow Christians. So you see, actually, in this response and in this reaction of Western media, the hold Zionist organizations have on mainstream outlets. And this is why Christians are not reacting to this horror, because they're simply not informed about it.
Well, Dawood, why do you think that we have seen this increase in violence by the Israeli regime recently in general? I mean, it's violent in general, but there has been definitely even more exaggerated than normal.
Well, you know that when there is no political horizon for people, they are frustrated. You know, right now, the Israeli prime minister said to the U.S. president, there will be no talks, there will be no meeting with the Palestinian leadership, and there will be no two-state solution. So the three no's that the Arabs said in 1967 are now become Israeli no's, and the Israelis are not interested in peace or even in negotiations. So without peace, without negotiations, the level of frustration because of the lack of horizon is quite high, and so people are basically left to fight for themselves, to defend themselves. And we're going to have a very bloody year if there isn't any genuine intervention. The U.S. is already giving lip service to the fact that they're against the settler violence. I think we need much more than that. I think we need an international peace force, to step in, because the Israeli army is not a neutral party. The Israeli army, as the Israeli human rights organizations have said, are part of the problem. They are part of the strategic Israeli long-term plan of removing or weakening the Palestinian presence in Palestine.
Well, what do you think about that, Hafsa, what Dawood said, that what's needed is an international force to intervene here? What's your thought about that?
I mean, in absolute terms, why not? Anything that could stop the bloodshed and the suffering of Palestinians and also limit the use of force by Israeli forces would be something to be welcomed. But of course, Israeli lobbies actually have a strict control of major international institutions, mainly the UN, which in itself is highly reliant on US funds and support, and therefore abides by whatever Israel wants to do. So it's highly unlikely that all the Israelis have to do is simply say no, they won't have international forces, and we won't see international forces. In particular, there will always be a reason why those forces won't be accepted. The Arabs will be seen as biased, so they won't have Arabs. Those Arabs that have normalized will be refused for other reasons. From African countries, they'll be seen as perhaps having some sort of solidarity against colonization. So the Israelis will find any excuse to oppose it, and I think they will simply get their way by not having an international force. Picking up on my co-panelist's point about the Israelis, no. I think we also have to remember very sadly that the recent normalizations by Arab countries has almost sort of emboldened Israel, because of course, why should they concede anything now, since they keep having the cake and eating it? They have the unconditional support of Europe, they have the unconditional support of the US, and of course, more recently, they've managed to normalize with nothing in return with many Arab countries, and therefore they have really no reason to negotiate any form of peace treaty with the Palestinians, because all the cards so far are sadly in their hands. Of course, Palestinian resistance is still the only option, and sadly that's going to cost lives, but that is the only way forward for the Palestinian cause.
Well, Hafsa, actually you answered my next question about that, Dawood, what I was going to say about Israel being emboldened by what has happened with the culpability of these Arab regimes. I want your perspective. How big of a role, Dawood, has this played in making the regime even more aggressive?
Well, I think the Israelis are caught because they are stuck in a situation where theoretically they dream of controlling all of the Palestinian areas, but they have a semblance of attempt to have a difference between the army and the settlers. In reality, we all know that there is no difference between settlers and the army. Each has different roles to play, but they both are on the one side, on the same side. And we have seen pictures and videos, many of Israeli soldiers giving their guns to the settlers, protecting the settlers, and basically enabling them. So I think it's very embarrassing to the Israeli army that they are unable to control their own population, settler population. And I think they all know that the Israeli government is a settler government. It's led by a former head of a settlement movement. And they will not be punished. They will not be held accountable for their actions. You know, they've burnt farms, they've cut down all the trees, they've desecrated homes, as well as what my colleague said, churches, and attacked religious people. So the settler violence is being held with impunity. There is no reason for them to stop it, and the army does not have the courage or the ability or the will to stop the settler violence. So I don't know if it's being encouraged by the army, but certainly it's not being discouraged by the army.
Hafsa, your perspective, how big of a role do you see these Western governments playing in all of this? Because you talked about the United Nations before, and we look at the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France. I mean, we just name and we go on. Would the Israelis be this emboldened and arrogant if these governments actually put pressure on them, or were not as supportive as they are?
Oh, absolutely not. I think Israel would collapse as a project if it wasn't upheld with the money from the US, with the political support from everywhere. We keep hearing that it's, you know, a startup country with all sorts of amazing things and technological advancement, but absolutely all these things have been made possible with the unconditional support and funds coming from the West, and also the means to support it, i.e. not taxing goods coming from Israel, allowing imports, giving sort of freeway imports for Israeli goods, and so allowing Israeli businesses to flourish when these relationships don't exist with other countries. So Project Israel would not exist had it not been for this unconditional support of the US and Western countries. But of course, the relationship has slightly sort of changed over the past, because originally Israel was sort of created as an outpost to serve Western interests in the heart of the Arab world. But over the years, through Zionist, very powerful and very well-funded Zionist organization, you have these organizations that have started buying, in essence, politicians from across these many influential countries. And therefore, what has happened is you have these very influential politicians, whether in Washington, whether in Canada, in London, in the UK, in France, etc. They are in the heart of the political establishment, and they are there, funded by Israel, only to serve Israeli interests. So what happens is you have in the heart of these very powerful countries groups that are not, that do not have the interests of their fellow citizens at heart, but rather Israel. And so you now have Israel literally controlling perhaps is a big word, but actually having incredible influence at the top echelons of Western political power.
Well, does the Israeli regime, does it actually think it's invincible that we see this increase in violence, or is it that it is increasingly afraid of dealing with the Palestinians and losing its grip over them?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, Israel is an occupying power that's depending almost totally on the military might of the Israeli army, protecting the Jewish settlers, but also using all kinds of levers, intelligence levers and economic levers, to keep the Palestinians at bay and quiet and so on. It's not working. It's not working because Mahmoud Abbas is unable to, or unwilling, or not interested in becoming the policeman of the Israelis, now that the Israelis are also cutting off some of the funds that are supposed to come to the Palestinians, which are taxes that Israel collects for the Palestinians. So the Israelis have to carry out their own security to a certain degree. Now, they're still on the big issues. The Palestinian police will probably prevent any major attacks on Israel or bombings. But on day-to-day things, especially in the settlement area, the Palestinians are rather united on the ground in opposing any kind of a settler violence or attempts to rebuild any settlement postings or housing or whatever. So, it's not a very easy situation for the Israelis. Now, so far, they basically had it easy. They have not suffered any financial or human cost for the occupation. And I think this is the key to the end of the occupation, is once the occupation costly in human terms or financial terms or other terms, that's when we'll see a change in Israel.
Hafsa, the Palestinian Authority is calling for the international community to intervene and stop Israeli aggression. Your thoughts about that, and why does the PA still look toward the so-called international community when clearly very little has been done by the UN for Palestine since Israel's establishment?
Yes, that's actually a good question to which I'm not sure I have an actual answer, but I do know that the PA, and especially under Mahmoud Abbas, has been absolutely dire in pushing the Palestinian narratives in a positive way, and in an effective way, in major Western capitals. It has literally become almost, I mean, the Al Fatah and the security apparatus almost does Israel's dirty work. It hasn't done anything towards reconciliation with Hamas. It continues to almost serve Israeli interests more than it serves the Palestinian cause. And so therefore, the Israelis are actually quite happy to have Mahmoud Abbas in place, because he's not really doing anything for the Palestinian cause. And you would have expected that he's been in power now for many years. He's a rather elderly gentleman. And the decent thing to do would have been to step down and let a new leadership take over, fresh blood, a new discourse, something that would be more palatable in across media, across the world. But he's not doing that, simply because the Israelis want him to remain, because he's simply not acting in the interest of the Palestinian people.
Well, Dawood, I mean, if 250 people had been injured anywhere else in the world, it would make headlines, but that doesn't seem to be the case with Palestinians when dealing with corporate media. Little or nothing is being said about this. I mean, 250 people being injured in one night is absolutely astonishing. Your assessment of this and what needs to change?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. There's one way which says that there's international exhaustion of the Palestinian issue. They've been covering it for a while, and unless there's a lot of deaths involved, they if it bleeds, it bleeds type of thing. But there are bleeding, and yet still they're not paying attention. So it's hard to answer that question on the eve of Christmas and the Christmas activities, as you said in your introduction, 2 hours away from the birth of Christ, are all these injuries happening, and yet the media totally ignored what's happening. This is a problem we have had for a while.
Well, doesn't it show the hypocrisy of it all? On the one hand, they could be having major coverage of Christmas, and then on the other hand, 2 hours away from where Jesus was born, all of this violence is taking place simultaneously.
They're not interested. They're not interested in a bad story on Christmas Eve. They want to give people some positive stories in their own eyes, and they, it's very convenient for the pro-Israeli media to stay away from stories of bloodshed or attacks, and certainly of the Israelis, because they still are basically upholding to what they call a Judeo-Christian attitude, which, they remember in Sunday school about Jesus and Bethlehem and so on. The last thing they want to do is show the Israelis shooting at Palestinian civilians. But this is a reality, and the media is basically, as you said, they are being hypocrites to their own oath, to their own media guideline that says that you should cover things like this, and at least give the balance, say there is something happening in Bethlehem and Christmas, but also in Palestine people are being denied to live freely and are being attacked because some radical Jewish settlers want to march in the middle of a Palestinian community. So yes, that is hypocrisy, but it's not the first time.
Well, Hafsa, Palestinians have been more united than ever. I mean, if we look at the resistance this year, has this phase, would you say this has entered a new intifada or not?
I don't know. We've had this point before about the new intifada. I think now it's kind of, there is fatigue on all sides. If I can just pick up on one point about the Christian element of what's happening now, I think we also have to underline the absolute failure of Christian churches across the world in failing to report this and to make adequate condemnation. As I said at the beginning, had it been Islamists attacking churches or places of worship at one of the most sensitive times of the Christian calendar, it would have been widespread coverage, and you would have heard the major Christian authorities, figure of authority, actually reacting to this. So we also, in the same way that we often pinpoint the Muslim clerics when they fail in certain aspects, etc., I think we also have to hold the Christian authorities responsible for the absolute and abject failure in condemning this violence and these desecrations that are occurring in the Holy Land and on the holiest of days for Christians. Picking up, sorry, on your point about...
Well, it's okay. Let me get Dawood in. Let me get Dawood in, actually, because I only have a couple of minutes left. Dawood, at this point in time, is there anything but resistance that will lead to some type of answer for the Palestinians? You said in the very beginning there's the three no's. So if it's no for negotiations, no for basically anything, as you were saying, do they have any choice but to resist?
No, I don't think Palestinians have any much choice, because they, unfortunately, Israel and probably the world only understands things when there is continuous resistance. Now, I'm not in favor of military resistance, but I think nonviolent popular resistance is something that has to be done. It's the only way that you continue to keep the things hot, if you will. Even if the media doesn't cover it, sooner or later there will be coverage. And I think, yes, we are entering in a phase. I think 2022 is going to be a very chaotic year. There will be a lot of bloodshed because the Israelis have no political plan. They have no strategy. And without a strategy, that basically means the population, 5 million Palestinians or more, have no hope, have no aspiration. They don't see their leaders meeting and having negotiations and to give some hope. And, we're Christmas time. It's a time of giving people hope, peace on earth, goodwill to all people. we don't see that. And without the peace on earth and without goodwill, the frustration will be very high.
All right. Well, I'd like to get Hafsa back in here, but I'm out of time. Unfortunately, I appreciate both of you being with me on the spotlight. Hafsa Khair Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London, and Dawood Qutb, award-winning Palestinian journalist out of Amman. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَقَالُوا أَسَاطِيرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ اكْتَتَبَهَا فَهِيَ تُمْلَى عَلَيْهِ بُكْرَةً وَأَصِيلًا
And they say, legends of the former peoples which he has written down, and they are dictated to him morning and afternoon.
The fifth verse of this chapter says, وَقَالُوا أَسَاطِيرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ اكْتَتَبَهَا فَهِيَ تُمْلَى عَلَيْهِ بُكْرَةً وَأَصِيلًا And they say, Quran is the stories of the ancients. He has got them written, so they are dictated before him morning and evening. So at first, those unbelievers, when they faced the invitation of the holy prophets to the truth and the Almighty Allah, they started attributing false beliefs to him. The purpose of the word old fables is whether they believe that some persons wrote for him, قَالُوا أَسَاطِيرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ اكْتَتَبَهَا or they said the Prophet ﷺ was literate and negated his being uneducated. In these holy verses, one of their derivative analyses and meaningless pretexts about the Holy Quran is talked about. So it says, قالوا أساطير الأولين. They say Quran is the stories of the ancients. اكتتبها. He has got them written. This means that he, in fact, has nothing by himself. He has no knowledge, he has no innovation, he's not connected to any superpower, and he doesn't know anything, let alone revelation and prophethood. Some persons have helped him to gather some old legends and named it Heavenly Book. اكتتبها. He has got them written for him. He has gotten help from the others. So he is helped by the others every day in order to achieve this aim of making us believe this is a heavenly book.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The verse continues saying, فَهِيَ تُمْلَى عَلَيْهِ بُكْرَةً وَأَصِيلًا. They are dictated before him, morning and evening. He is helped in every morning, in every evening, when there are few people out. And that's how they justified themselves being from among the unbelievers. So we can see the different somehow exposures of iniquity in these unbelievers. Also in the previous verse, you may remember, their inability to bring a book like the Quran was the reason for their lie. And of course, the reason for their iniquity. And that's why the previous verse said, فَقَدْ جَاءُوا ظُلْمًا وَزُورًا. Indeed, they have done injustice and uttered a falsehood. So here, they also argue that the Holy Prophet is helped in every morning and every evening when there are only a few people out and these helps to him cannot be seen. This is, in fact, the explanation of the false accusations that were mentioned in the previous verse. And why these short sentences, the unbelievers intend to impose some weak points in the Holy Quran. By saying so, they argue that the Holy Quran has got no new matter, it has no new subject, and it is some old legends. And more importantly, the Holy Prophet ﷺ cannot continue his job without others' helps, and every morning and evening matters must be read out to him. And he writes them in order to retell those stories to us. And the third point is that he can write and read. And if he says that he is not educated, he, the Prophet, is lying. Because he's getting help from the others. The others are reading out these legends and old stories to him. And he copies and writes them in order to memorize them. And this means he's not illiterate and he's lying. Ultimately, as a matter of fact, they intended to break up people who were with the Holy Prophet sallallahu, all wise persons who had lived for a time in that society knew well that the Prophet sallallahu had not been educated by anybody and had nothing to do with the Jews and the people of the book. Dear listeners, we'll continue talking about this verse and also the next in the later programs. Thank you for staying with us. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
It was supposed to ensure seamless trade between the UK and the EU following Brexit. But the Northern Ireland Protocol has become a problem itself. Or has it? Negotiated in 2019, the protocol was aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland, still in the EU's single market, and EU member Republic of Ireland. Instead, it's created a regulatory border in the Irish Sea, which acts as a de facto EU-UK frontier. Now, British goods entering Northern Ireland are subject to EU checks and customs regulations. While some have disliked the protocol from day one, others have found it beneficial.
From a business perspective, the Brexit and backstance in the protocol has been a good thing for the people of the North of Ireland. Obviously, we have the best of both worlds. But if you listen to a small minority that is being platformed by the media, both in Britain and the North of Ireland here, you would think that the protocol was damaging business.
That small minority are elements in the loyalist or unionist community in Northern Ireland, people who wish their country to remain part of the UK. They feel they have been cut off from the mainland. Before becoming Prime Minister, Boris Johnson had told pro-UK parties that he didn't want to see Northern Ireland left abandoned by a border in the sea.
Now, I have to tell you, no British Conservative government could or should sign up to any such arrangement.
That assurance fell by the wayside. A sense of betrayal prevailed. Protests ensued. To the UK government, that meant changing the goalposts.
The protocol is not working. It's completely lost consent in one community in Northern Ireland. It's not doing the thing it was set up to do. protect the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. In fact, doing the opposite.
A fact only admitted after the UK left the EU. The European Union rejected any renegotiation of the deal. Some experts believe the government must have known about the problems ahead from day one of Brexit, calling into question the UK's credibility as an international trading partner.
The UK has absolutely no credibility internationally. We've seen that the two biggest partners in the world, the EU and the American government, have made statements on how they feel about the UK renegotiating international treaties. So even to make any kind of statement with that the UK have any integrity on the international stage now is laughable. The UK have no credibility since the Tory government and Brexit.
Another bone of contention, the UK government's demand to remove the EU's legal oversight role, part of the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying as long as the role of the European Court of Justice continues, the protocol will never survive. But in early December, Prime Minister Johnson's Conservative government reluctantly dropped that demand, at a time when it would appear the majority of people in Northern Ireland want an end to the standoff.
Whether they be Irish unionists or Irish nationalists, of course, the Tories have always used unionist for the old divide and conquer strategy here in the North of Ireland. So I think it's just sheer incompetence and of course, the arrogance in it.
Things took a turn for the worse for the UK Prime Minister with the December 18 high-profile resignation of his chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, who was replaced less than 24 hours later by Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who openly backed remaining in the EU in 2016. She's now tasked with resolving her country's differences with the EU, what nearly 2 years of negotiations by her predecessor failed to do.
The UK blames the EU for being inflexible and worrying too much about the so-called integrity of their single market. And Brussels blames London for trying to scrap an international treaty that it signed nearly 2 years ago. Experts say there's no obvious way out of the ongoing stalemate, meaning that Brexit is not exactly done yet. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Telecom is a major ICT exhibition in Iran that brings together both private and state actors in information and communication technology to showcase their products and services. After a limited edition last year due to the coronavirus pandemic, the annual event has this year opened its doors to all domestic companies to participate.
Our company produces smart systems that work based on the Internet of Things, and recently we produced a smart assistant for animal farming, which helps the farmer monitor the health of livestock and their latest needs.
In the past 2 years, due to the coronavirus pandemic and the growing trend toward remote learning, we thought it would be a good idea to produce tablets for students to easily follow up on their online education. We are also active in producing apps for a range of uses with a focus on telemedicine.
When it comes to ICT, any advancement affects all other industries. The emergence of the 5G network, for example, was a game changer for surgical operations, allowing telesurgeries to be conducted seamlessly and with higher precision. Like this newly unveiled Iranian-made robotic surgeon called Sina, which uses 5G to allow a remote surgery to be carried out.
Sina's surgery system has two main subsystems: a master robotic console at the surgeon's side and a slave robotic system at patient's side, which are connected through a 5G wireless network. So any movement of my hands here are transferred to the slave robotic arms, and it is as if the surgeon is present beside the patient.
For sanctions hit Iran, it's not an easy task to catch up with modern trends in the ICT. However, the government says it has tripled its allocated budget for the ICT this year to encourage local firms to push the industry forward and promote what it refers to as digital economy.
The increase in the allocated budget is a result of the government's special attention to the ICT sector. We are planning to promote electronic government and move away from traditional market toward online market. All this needs a strong infrastructure which the government needs to build.
The government says it is also trying to capitalize on venture capital funds and accelerators to move the ICT sector forward, In recent years, an increasing number of sponsoring firms have turned to this area to support innovative ideas and lead them to the market, the results of which remain to be seen in the years to come.
The ICT sector in Iran is among the hardest hit by U.S. sanctions, but the country says it views any challenge as an opportunity. Officials say this expo gives a small picture of how Iran's ICT has thrived under pressure and tried to keep abreast of the fast-growing trend in the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target. That is to make India as a fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Haridwar from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Hundreds attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. They came to drum up support, especially for female Palestinian prisoners who have been subjected to inhumane and oppressive measures inside Israeli prisons and detention centers. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners. Hamas movement accused the Israeli prison service of deliberately targeting female prisoners and endangering their lives.
We are witnessing a Friday of rage all over Palestine to support prisoners who are languishing inside Zionist jails. The Palestinian people will not sit idle while female prisoners are being humiliated and beaten by the Zionist captors. We hold the Zionist regime fully responsible for the lives of the female prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Palestinian female prisoners continue to face a wide range of human rights violations in Israeli jails, under the watchful eye of the international community.
Attacking female prisoners and placing them in solitary confinement is cruel and inhumane. Nowadays, all prisoners are suffering, especially during the cold winter season, and we call on the Red Cross to exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its illegal practices against the prisoners. We also demand an international investigation team to probe Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners, including scores of women and children. Palestinian prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers under the administration of the Israeli Prison Service.
Female Palestinian prisoners are facing unprecedented attacks inside Israeli jails, and these attacks are taking place on a daily basis. Any attack on Palestinian female prisoners is an attack on all Palestinians. As we stand here, we warn the Israeli regime that it must immediately stop such attacks against female prisoners.
Many Palestinian prisoners also suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment.
Thousands of Palestinian prisoners are currently languishing inside Israeli jails. Securing their release is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In January 2020, a little less than 2 years ago, the UK officially left the European Union. After years of political wrangling, it was finally time for the British government to live up to its Brexit pledges. So what were they?
When it comes to the economy, the British government has made flowery promises. Tariff-free trade with the EU with minimum bureaucracy. £350 million that would have been given to Brussels, given to the NHS instead. Higher wages for all, and new trade deals, and access to a European trading zone from Iceland to Russia. So how is that going? We asked British investment manager and business commentator Justin Stewart if any of these pledges have come to fruition.
We are all very confused, but most people would say that actually the government has not made good on its arrangements for exiting the EU, other than the fact they've gone through with the exit. But we haven't had the rest of the agreement. Fishing, farming, finance regulations, all those elements are still up in the air.
And there was another promise worth mentioning, a VAT cut on energy bills that would save the average household £64 a year. Well, as of spring 2022, people might see their energy bills double due to an unexpected energy crisis. So what happened there?
What they wanted to do is have more power companies enter the market, so there was more competition, which is a good idea. However, if the quality of the companies themselves didn't really understand the market, then actually when the price started going up, these companies were made of nothing. They had no experience, didn't understand how to buy forward pricing of oil and gas, and so when the price went up very strongly indeed, they weren't in a position to actually try and look after their customers or even their business, and so they went bust.
And as a result of higher energy prices, the Centre for Economics and Business Research predicts in 2022, a typical UK family will spend £1,700 more per year on household costs, with the inflation rate rising to its highest in a decade.
It's going to be hard for people to live. It will. It will. Especially the elderly. Especially the elderly. Yeah, all right, they may get a pension, but that's nothing.
We were just commenting, just coming down here now, the price of petrol still hasn't gone back down again. You know, it seems once it's gone up, it's just continuing.
It's not just, I'm already worried about it because we can see there's lots of problems with energy companies that are going bust, and my own did as well, and it's been transferred, and I've seen the prices and they are astronomical.
These are hard times in Britain, with Brexit-related fuel, food and retail delivery shortages leaving more than half the British population feeling Brexit is going badly. But in the press, it's not all doom and gloom. The BBC says the UK economy is set to grow at its fastest rate in more than 70 years. The Telegraph says British growth has surpassed China for the first time in 40 years. And according to The Express, the UK economy is set to outperform every Eurozone nation with double the growth of Germany. So what do the experts say about such forecasts?
Yes, of course, you're going to see an immediate bounce back in the economy because that's what happens when you shut it down. It bounces back. The key element happens after that. Where does the sustained growth come from? And what you're talking about now from the Chancellor in the government saying a 6% growth next year and thereafter, no, that's not going to happen. It's going to be a much, much slower level of growth and probably in the region of maybe 2, 3%, something like that. So what you've got the government doing is talking up the economy, and you can understand why they want to try and do it, because they want to try and increase confidence.
Are big businesses confident to stay and operate in the UK? Are Britons confident to start up their own small businesses and keep the wheels of the economy turning? Only time will tell.
Of course, we cannot ignore the fact that we are still in the grips of a global pandemic. Tens of thousands of people have died in the UK as a result of COVID-19, even though it was the first country to start vaccinating. Lockdown after lockdown have taken their toll, and now we have the new Omicron variant.
The hospitality industry is reeling from the government's mixed messages over Omicron ahead of Christmas. It's forecast to lose £300 million worth of trade over the holidays, and some businesses have decided to close already due to staffing issues, cancellations, and an overall downturn in trade. So for them, this comes far too late in the day.
We don't think today that there is enough evidence to justify any tougher measures before Christmas.
According to the OECD, the British economy is recovering and expected to reach pre-crisis levels at the beginning of 2022. But growth will rely primarily on household spending. The average family spends 29% more in the weeks before Christmas. And that might be why, despite Omicron, the government has chosen to accelerate the booster jab rollout and not cancel Christmas. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As millions of Yemenis face the threat of drowning into a famine due to the ongoing Saudi lid war on the country, the World Food Programme says it will reduce its food rations to 8 million people in Yemen starting next month due to a lack of funding.
What the World Food Programme has done is a clear escalation against civilians and will primarily harm children and women who depend on humanitarian aid for their survival. The United Nations bears full responsibility because it's primarily responsible for humanitarian aid and it's supposed to protect civilians, not help international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis.
The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe since the aid reaches only a very small number of people and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operate expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi lid war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
President Vladimir Putin has talked about Moscow's security proposals presented to the NATO alliance last week. Speaking during his annual press conference, he said it is the Western countries that must immediately give Russia security guarantees, not the other way around.
They told us in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. What is the result? They cheated us. They simply impudently cheated us with NATO's five waves of expansion. Now the corresponding systems are already appearing in Romania and Poland. Have we approached the borders of the US or Britain? They have approached ours, and now they say Ukraine will also be a NATO member.
Prominent Russian journalists who have worked in the presidential pool for 20 years believe that Putin's statements serve as a deterrent against the West.
It seems to me that he should not be fascinated by anything for a long time, but he himself sets the vector of many agreements, follows a path that is sometimes completely unexpected for many, hinting that if it is ignored, then retaliatory actions will follow. And since no one knows what they can be, they start to get scared. This is a deterrent.
Speaking about Ukraine, Putin said that Russia was responding to threats from Kyiv. He said Kyiv does not want to honor the Minsk agreements and adopts laws that run counter to these accords. Putin said Ukraine and the West want to portray Russia as a party of a conflict in that country. He said incumbent Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been under the influence of radical elements after coming to power, like the country's previous leaders.
There must be tension for the hegemon to change. The hegemon, which is America and the English-speaking world, will not just give itself up. But this hegemon does not have enough strength, and we are watching it trying to enter into negotiations.
On Afghanistan, Putin stated that Afghanistan needs a government that represents its entire people so it can be recognized by the international community. He asserted that the countries that occupied Afghanistan for two decades should be the first to offer aid. He called on the West to unfreeze Afghanistan's financial assets, warning that the country is on the brink of famine.
Putin holds a big press conference every year in the